Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. On July 2nd, 1937, Amelia Earhart vanished over the Pacific Ocean. She was two-thirds of the way through her big attempt to be the first person to fly the Earth's circumference at the equator. She may have fallen off the map, but her spectacular image as a female icon, a fearless high flyer, endures. Director Mira Nair is telling her story again in the new film Amelia, opening this weekend with Hilary Swank as Amelia Earhart and Richard Gere as her publicist husband. Today we have biographer Susan Butler, who's told Earhart's story and advised the filmmakers. This hour On Point, the real Amelia Earhart. You can join the conversation. What is it about Amelia Earhart that stays so compelling, so fresh, after all these years? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's a clip from the trailer for Amelia with Hilary Swank and Richard Gere. The film opens Friday.
When I was a little girl, I'd spend hours just dreaming that someday I would go to strange, faraway places.
Miss Amelia Earhart.
Why do you want to fly?
I want to be free.
That's the movie version. She had plenty of appeal all on her own. Here's a newsreel, 1932, entitled Heroine of the Skies, Three Cheers for Miss Amelia Earhart, Lady Lindy, as in Lindbergh, Charles Lindbergh, talking about her marvelous dual Atlantic flights.
Here you see Lady Lindy, whose triumphant flight across the Atlantic is the admiration of the whole world. What a wonderful woman. And isn't she like Lindbergh?
And here's the woman herself, a press conference with Amelia Earhart from the early 1930s after a transatlantic flight. Amelia, darling, she's standing with tousled hair before the propellers among a crowd of admirers. This is from the 1993 PBS documentary, Amelia Earhart, The Price of Courage.
Yesterday I hopped off from Los Angeles about noontime and landed in Newark this morning after a nonstop transcontinental trip.
And what did you carry on the trip?
You mean to eat?
Yeah, to eat and drink.
Well, I carried some water, of course, because my cockpit is very warm. And I carried a sandwich in case. I didn't eat it, though. I carried some hot chocolate and the old reliable tomato juice.
What kind of a sandwich was it?
Chicken sandwich.
They're the real Amelia Earhart. Later this hour, we will hear from a remarkable female pilot from World War II days who was inspired to fly by Amelia Earhart, the real deal. But joining us right now from New York is biographer Susan Butler. She is author of East to the Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart, first out in 1997 and just reissued. The book was optioned for the movie Amelia opening this week, and she's been a consultant to the filmmakers. Amelia, directed by Mira Nair, opens this Friday. Susan Butler, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me.
What a story, and it never seems to lose its luster. Why is that? Not everybody. I mean, even Charles Lindbergh somehow doesn't have the same tang and glam anymore.
Well, I think Earhart is a really compelling image for women, and I think right now her message is even more important than it was when she died. I think actually the world is just catching up to her right now.
Her message, and how would you put her message? Is it the message of fearlessness? Is it the message of female empowerment? How do you take it?
Well, no, it wasn't female empowerment. That's why she was so popular. She wasn't threatening. What she was saying to women was, listen, don't live vicariously through your husbands. Be all that you can be, and you'll have fun doing it, and you'll both benefit. Men and women will benefit if women are more adventurous, more independent, and better educated.
Boy, though, in those days, that was a big step up for a lot of women, and she was by no means shy about talking about women and what they ought to do. I've got one more clip here, Susan Butler. This is Amelia Earhart herself again in the 1930s, again from the PBS documentary, talking about women and achievement and equality.
I've had practical experience
and know the discrimination against women in various forms of industry. A pilot's a pilot. I hope that such equality could be carried out in other fields so that men and women may achieve equally in any endeavor they set out.
The Amelia Earhart of gender politics, and at the same time, she was one of our first really, really big celebrities. Susan, I wonder if you'd start by just setting the context for what made aviation such a perfect platform for fame, celebrity, glory in the late 1920s and right into the 30s.
Well, it was the age of adventure. It wasn't just flying that was in the news. Flying to the poles, Admiral Byrd, all the record flights because planes were a very new technological invention, and they were very dangerous. And so there weren't that many people who were courageous enough to go into an airplane in the late 20s, or actually she started flying in the early 20s, mm-hmm. But still by the late 20s, when a record flight was made and Lindbergh was 27, the whole world went just absolutely bananas. It seemed like a miracle for human beings to be off the earth.
She went across in 1928, which made her the sort of Lindy.
As a passenger, she didn't do a thing.
And she was very upfront about that. She said, I was just a sack of potatoes on that flight, but she was celebrated for it, did it herself not long after. Who was Amelia Earhart, Susan Butler? Where did she come from? How did she come to be at the center of all this flying glory?
Well, she was born in Atchison, Kansas in 1897, and she grew up there in Kansas. And she grew up as a very independent young woman at a very young age. There are quite a few stories about her when she was young, how she constructed a roller coaster. She constructed it herself. She got rails and had them going from the top of a shed to the ground, and then she had a little kind of a box that she had rolling down it. And she was always trying to do new things. But besides that, she was, of course, a tomboy and enjoyed doing all kinds of physical activities. And in her school, she introduced basketball for girls. Girls didn't do that. They were supposed to be very dainty and retiring in those years. She always, from the time she was a child, wanted to have an adventurous life. She grew up with two cousins, Catch and Lucy Chalice, and the three of them, because I got the diaries from one of the sisters, from Catch. Mm. The three of them are talking not about the men they're going to marry, but how different they're going to be when they grow up, how different from their mothers. They're going to have adventurous, exciting lives, adventurous, exciting careers. Right from the get-go, she was bound and determined to have an exciting life and to be her own person.
That first crossing of the Atlantic, where she wasn't the pilot but certainly got the glory, she wasn't intended to be the woman on that flight. This was an adventure made for newsreel that had been dreamed up and financed by
Amy Guest,
a wealthy couple. And when her husband said she couldn't do it, or they looked for a suitable stand-in. Why did they pick Amelia?
Well, it wasn't they. It was just Amy. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's debatable whether her husband ever was told about it until it was too late for him to stop the whole enterprise. Mm-hmm. But she was chosen. She was already a pilot, and Amy Guest, when her children talked her out of it because they just said they didn't want to lose their mother. She said, "Okay, I won't go. If you can find me a substitute who is a suitable American woman who's educated, a lady." She was very upfront about it. She wanted it to be a woman who would be a credit to all America, because she knew how important it was going to be the first woman, and that whoever that first woman was going to be would be famous all over the world. So she wanted to find a suitable substitute who would do her proud and do the United States proud.
And they went out and looked for someone who actually looked kind of like Charles Lindbergh. Well, not really. No?
No. Okay. But when George Palmer Putnam actually was the person in who was put in charge of the search, and after he took a look at Amelia, he thought that she would sell better as a Lady Lindy. And so he instructed the photographer who was taking those first pictures to make her look.
There you go. All right. You've got
like
it.
Lindy.
Of course. And she did sell, and she did excel. I mean, she flew it herself. She wasn't the only lady pilot of those years by any means, but she stood so much in the forefront. Was it because she married a publicist who sort of knew how to sell her particular story and image?
Well, he was good, but she was the first American woman to get an FAA license. She had already set an altitude record in the early 20s by the time George Palmer Putnam found her and she became so famous. So it was partly her and partly him. It was a great partnership.
It's the source of the core story of the movie. We'll ask you about the movie after a little break here. But just to start with, as a biographer, do you like it? Does it fit the Amelia Earhart story that you found in the actual documents of her life?
Yes. Yes, I think they did a wonderful job. She has Hillary has the persona. She really nailed the part. She worked very hard at it, and she's done a wonderful job.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Amelia Earhart, American flyer. She is back on the big screen. She never left the world's imagination. Susan Butler is with us, biographer of Amelia Earhart and consultant to the new film starring Hilary Swank as Earhart. Here's a little clip. The film's out this Friday in theaters. Here's a clip where she's landed her bright red plane on a rolling sheep pasture somewhere, I guess, across the Atlantic. And here she's embarking.
Excuse me, sir. Where am I?
In Gallagher's pasture. Where are you supposed to be?
When I left, I was aiming for Paris.
Oh, you missed, you know. It's over there.
Well, hello, sheep.
Hilary Swank as Amelia Earhart disembarking there. It sounds like Ireland to me. I haven't seen the film yet. It's out on Friday. Susan Butler joins us from New York. And right now, from Berkeley, California, we're joined by Maggie G. We want to get a sense of how Amelia Earhart was perceived and her impact in her day. Maggie G. was inspired by Earhart's story to become a pilot herself. She flew with the Women Air Force Service Pilots, the WASPs, during World War II. She was recently awarded a Congressional Medal of Honor for her services. She's the subject of a new children's book, Sky High, The True Story of Maggie G. She joins us right now from California. Maggie G., thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Am I on now?
You're very much on, and we're very honored to have you. Congratulations on your Congressional Medal of Honor. Take us back to when you were a girl and being inspired by Amelia Earhart. Where and how, madam?
Well, I'm from Berkeley, California, and when I was growing up, the news in the newspapers and on the radio were about flights, though, and our heroes of those particular time were Amelia Earhart and Charles Lindbergh. I mean, these were the people who were out there looking for adventure, and if you're a little person at that particular time, you thought, wouldn't it be just wonderful to do all these great things? And on Sundays, when we were children, we used to go out to the airport to watch the planes take off and land, though. That was the excitement of the day.
And
it was police.
If I understand correctly, if the children's book about you has it right, there was a day when you thought you may have seen Amelia Earhart at the airport.
I suspect so, though, because she didn't come in very often, though, but she did come in a couple of times. And I do remember seeing her just going out there, and there was this woman, though, and it had to be Amelia Earhart, though. There weren't very many women pilots at that time.
You were in a Chinese-American family. You were no shrinking violet yourself, worked as a shipyard welder and draftsman at the beginning of World War II. You learned to fly a plane when you were 18, went on to get degrees in physics and mathematics at UC Berkeley, and spent a long time as an accomplished physicist at the Livermore Lab. What did Amelia...
Yes, I did all those things, and so, I've had a good life.
But when you were flying in World War II, where were you flying, and what were you doing, and how unusual was that?
Well, in our particular group, the WAAS, we did everything in the sense that we flew all Army planes. I didn't fly all of them, because I got in quite late. But the idea of the WAAS was the Air Transport Command. They were ferrying the planes from the factories to the port of embarkation, though, to be taken overseas. So, but none of the women went overseas to flew the planes overseas. But yes, I have to say, Amelia Earhart was very much our heroine at that particular time, and most of us women, though. She sort of set the pace for us. I mean, she's the one that pointed that out that women could do anything the men could do, particularly in flight at that time.
Do you remember getting that message, not just seeing her, you know, looking so marvelous flying through the sky, but actually getting the message that women can do anything?
Yes. At that particular time, you have to say this was the 1930s, and girls were mostly getting married. And some of them, you know, quite a few went to college, but the idea was to find a husband, though. But our particular group of women who were, at least my colleagues who were flying at that particular time, were more interested in flying than anything else. I mean, that was our dream, and that's what we wanted to do.
Are you happy to see her back in the theaters, her story back in the theaters today for a new generation?
Oh, it's very nice to see the recognition of women in the very early days of flight, though. And I think Amelia is coming off. People are finding out a little more about her, and she's coming off very well.
Maggie G.
And I'm glad to see this movie come out.
Well, we're honored to have you with us today. By the way, for listeners, you can see a video of Maggie G. remembering her days as a World War II pilot at our website, onpointradio.org. It's a terrific story in itself, your story, Maggie G., and thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me on. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Susan Butler, there's the real deal, a voice of a woman who was a girl when Amelia Earhart was flying, who was inspired and flew in World War II as a direct result of the image, the message raised by this one very celebrated flyer.
It was wonderful listening to her. Men's attitudes towards women back then I have to tell you that the most amazing fact that I came upon was that the Air Transport Command, where Maggie was part of, they put out a booklet in 1943 ordering all its women's pilots to be grounded when they had their periods.
Because they
thought that women, when they were menstruating, were not capable of flying an airplane because they were under such emotional and physical stress. So the world has changed so much, and Amelia Earhart, just being the example that she was, always pulling everything off, you know, was one of the was probably the main reason why men thought that women could fly at all.
She took it on. She did a lot of it herself. She set plenty of her own records. Of course, ultimately died in one of those efforts. But I was absolutely struck by the letter that you include in your biography that she wrote to George Putnam on the eve of their wedding day or the day of their wedding.
The morning of their wedding.
The morning of their wedding.
It is a totally amazing document.
Totally amazing. She calls him GP. She addresses it to him. And she's sort of laying out the terms of what their marriage will be. And it's so forward.
It's riveting.
Absolutely riveting, spectacularly well written. But the clarity and sort of political courage within a marriage of this letter, I wish you'd read it for us and then give us some of the backdrop. Listeners, bear with us. This is Amelia Earhart to her husband-to-be on the day of their wedding. Well, let's hear it, if you would, Susan.
Okay. They were in the house of GP's mother. So she borrowed a piece of Mrs. Putnam's stationery, slipped off by herself, and this is what she wrote to her almost husband. Dear GP, there are some things which should be writ before we are married. things we have talked over before, most of them. You must know again my reluctance to marry, my feeling that I shatter thereby chances in work, which means so much to me. I feel the move just now as foolish as anything I could do. I know there may be compensations, but have no heart to look ahead. In our life together, I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. If we can be honest, I think the difficulties which arrive may be best avoided. Please let us not interfere with the other's work or play, nor let the world see our private joys or disagreements. In this connection, I may have to keep some place where I can go to be myself now and then, for I cannot guarantee to endure at all the confinements of even an attractive cage. I must exact a cruel promise, and that is you will let me go in a year if we find no happiness together. I will try and do my best in every way. And she signed it A.E., which is how he addressed her.
George Palmer, you write, hid that letter away and revealed its existence only after she died. But the clarity and courage, forthrightness, boldness there. I shall not hold you to any medieval code of faithfulness to me, nor shall I consider myself bound to you similarly. I mean, even today, that's pretty bold. Where did that courage, boldness come from?
The boldness is just, every time I read it, I'm taken aback again by its boldness. And it's breathtaking. It's just amazing.
Fred Kaplan reviewed your book when it first came out in 1997, and you know, points out this sort of androgynous figure that she cut. She, you know, had bomber jackets and trousers back in the day. He wrote then, reading your book, that she attracted both men and women, but which she was attracted to is less clear. Is it unclear to you?
No, it's perfectly clear to me. Although people do raise that issue. They think that there might be a bisexual quality in the way, in her persona, as we see it now. But I think we all forget that she grew up and she first came into womanhood in the flapper age. And the flapper age was when there was this huge, huge revolt against the Victorian age, where women were tightly laced into corsets and had elaborate hairdos and spent all day getting dressed up. And what they did was they cut their hair, bobbed hair, and they went as far as binding their breasts, because they wanted, the look was to look boyish. And she had the perfect figure. I mean, she was the perfect flapper image. There she was, 5'8", 118 pounds. And the dresses were cut to be boyish looking, quite flat. I mean, after all, they were binding their breasts, hipless. So that in her own age, she was simply being fashionable.
And everybody, sort of forever, it seems, wants that image to be associated with an image. Ms. Magazine put her on the cover years ago. Apple used her at the heart of an ad campaign. We have a lot of callers on Amelia Earhart. Susan Butler, stand by. Let's go to first to Tracy in Marlboro, Massachusetts. Hi, Tracy. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I did some genealogy research a few years back, and you know, there's a family story in our family lore that my grandfather was a wing walker with Amelia Earhart, and I wish we had pictures of that, but we don't. But one of the things I learned talking to a curator of an aviation museum was that the aviators back in that time were a pretty small community, and we really, all of us Americans now, really owe a debt of gratitude to the people of that time, because they were a dangerous, they did dangerous things that lot. You know, the planes of that time were prototypes of the military aircraft that the pilots use today. So what I learned was that, you know, all the aircraft that they flew back then, being such a small community, they worked with the military. And the woman you just had on earlier,
Maggie G. And maybe your grandfather may be out on one of the wings of the planes, perhaps, that Amelia Earhart flew.
Exactly. And so just as the caller, the woman you interviewed earlier, mm-hmm. talked about, you know, there was a lot of back and forth of adventure for fun, but also military careers mixed in there, and we've all benefited, I think, through the years from that.
Tracy, let us pick it up, and thank you for your call. Susan Butler, does the timing make sense? Would she have been barnstorming and taking wing whackers out on, you know, for derring do? Was that part of Amelia Earhart's story?
Well, I hate to puncture anybody's memories or
family tales. Yes,
family tales. But it's possible, but I never came across it, and I did, of course, an awful lot of research.
So we'll leave that one to the family archive. Maybe so, Tracy. We'll see. Donna in Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Donna, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I'm an airline pilot, and I, of course, I'm very inspired by Amelia Earhart. But one of the things that I've read extensively, almost every book that's ever been written about her, of course, my interest there. But one of the things that they kind of put forth is that she cut some corners on her trip around the world with not learning the radios and things that she needed to do. And I find that a little too bad. You know, men like to grab a hold of that against women pilots. We're not quite as smart or that still exists, unfortunately. So I was just wondering if that was true.
Susan Butler, there is that subtext running through, you know, some of the commentary on Amelia Earhart. Justified?
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, you know, I think that subtext just shows that women are still being discriminated against in a very strange way. That women, there's this lingering thought that women really, really, really are not as competent as men. I mean, so many of the pilots in those years died. Wiley Post, who was famous for going around the world, he was the first person to go around the world, although he didn't go around at his waistline. He did two circumnavigations of the world, and he crashed in Barrow, Alaska, in 1935, taking Will Rogers with him. Nobody thinks he's less of a pilot because he died in his plane. Everybody is always, not everybody, but there is this lingering subtext that because Amelia Earhart wasn't proficient. She knew the Morse code, but they say, well, you know, she wasn't all that competent because she was, as your last person.
Caller was saying here. Mm-hmm.
She cut corners. She didn't cut corners. She had the latest navigation equipment. We all know what GPS is. She had what was the latest navigational equipment on her plane, first civilian plane that had it, the RDF, Radio Direction Finders. And she thought that everything had been taken care of. I mean, it was a tragic communications error that brought her down. But that doesn't make her less of a pilot. Lindbergh was called Lucky Lindy because he was one of the few who made record flights who escaped unscathed. Most of the other pilots died.
Many, yes.
I'd like to say one more thing about the last flight, which is that you have to realize that the Pacific in those years was considered so dangerous because planes didn't have the range, engines mm-hmm. weren't very, very efficient. No plane took off from Hawaii, where we had a naval base, except one PBY, which started out and then turned around 500 miles short of Howland Island. No other plane took off to try and get to the scene of where she'd gone missing because nobody dared.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Amelia Earhart, American flyer. She is back on the big screen. She never left in much of the world's imagination. My guest this hour is Susan Butler, author of East to the Dawn, The Life of Amelia Earhart, biographer who was consulted for the film on the set as it got put together with Hilary Swank and Richard Gere. Here's a little clip. Richard Gere, Ewan McGregor, playing the father of Gore Vidal, presented in the film as a lover of Amelia Earhart outside that marriage, and Hilary Swank, of course, as Amelia. It's all in the theaters on Friday.
Everything about you is a menace.
Spoken by a man who should know.
Lots of people are quite taken with you.
How can I lose?
If you miss this island, you're out of fuel with 2,000 miles to go.
I understand the danger. I can handle it.
You wouldn't sell a salesman, would you? No one has made it.
I will.
Did you receive transmission?
From the movie, out this week, Susan Butler is with us, East to the Dawn. There's a lot here, but Vidal, this was part of the Franklin, the FDR administration. Amelia Earhart was close to Eleanor Roosevelt, I think flew her over Washington, if I read you correctly. And what's the story around her and Gore Vidal's father?
Well, Gore Vidal's father, Gene Vidal, was a very charismatic man and also in love with flying. He was West Point's first flying instructor, and he was also a super athlete. When he attended West Point, he kicked the winning field goal against Notre Dame and scored the running touchdown against Navy, and was an Olympic athlete and a hugely competent person. And Amelia was instrumental in convincing both Roosevelts, Eleanor and Franklin, to make him the first director of air commerce, the first head of civilian aviation in the United States.
And when his job was threatened, she brought the heat to bear on FDR, said, you've got to protect him, and he was protected.
Oh, yeah. She wrote a really serious, indignant telegram. Saying that she was, this is now 1936. She's not going to campaign for Franklin if Eugene Vidal gets fired.
Is it clear that he was her lover? Is that clear from your research?
Yes, it is clear from my research. I discovered it in the first place through the diaries of her cousin who lived with she and GP in Rye, in their house in Rye, New York, that he was visiting all the time. And then I was lucky enough to interview Jean Vidal's widow before she died. And she told me that she was sure that they had been lovers.
Got a lot of response here. We're going to look at just a moment at the vanishing of Amelia Earhart. But here's Rory. He says, as a 10-year-old tomboy growing up in the mid-70s, I did my sixth grade biography. This is from the website, school report on Amelia Earhart. I remember vividly dressing in knickers and jacket to proudly portray my hero as a girl, as she inspired in me possibility and courage. There from onpointradio.org. Kelly in West Ossipee, New Hampshire. Kelly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to say I'm an airline pilot, and I fly little airplanes for fun. And, of course, Amelia Earhart figures prominently in that. But one of the things that always kind of disappointed me is that she is our icon, the woman pilot that everybody knows of, but she failed at the end.
Her plane went down, and that has got to be considered a flying failure. So what do you make of that, Kelly?
Well, it's kind of disappointment. I think that there were other women pilots out there that did a much better job, but they didn't have the same publicist.
And weren't married to the publicist, for sure.
Yeah.
Susan, what about that?
Well, I really don't agree, because as I said, when I was researching the era, I kept running into all the pilots that had died. There was Lincoln Beachy. There was, as I said before, Wiley Post.
But I guess I'm thinking of other women. We've got here Jeanette at the website saying, what about Bessie Coleman? She was before Amelia. She was the first person in the U.S. to have an international aviation license. Why don't we talk about her? What makes Amelia more than Bessie, says Jeanette?
Well, she's just captured our imagination. I don't know why some people are just larger than life. She so dominated that era that I think that that she is still so popular because she was so dominant then. I mean, what Gore Vidal said was that, you forget, because he knew Jackie Kennedy, he was actually related to her. Mm. You know, he said, forget Garbo, forget Jackie. Walking down the street with Amelia Earhart was just different. She was beyond stardom. Everybody in her era thought she was a goddess. She was just so revered.
Let's get a call from New Haven.
And I think that's come down to us.
Yeah, it certainly has. Let's go to New Haven, Connecticut. And Robert, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks, Tom.
Yeah.
My grandfather was a very prominent inventor and engineer in Long Island in this period and worked at some point with Amelia Earhart and was deeply impressed with her ability as a mechanic. He said that she was as good as any man that he had ever met. And I'm wondering if Ms. Butler has run across in her research Winslow Pierce.
Susan Butler.
No, I have not come across the name of Winslow Pierce, but yes, Earhart was a good mechanic. She took a course in automobile mechanics to learn how to take apart an engine of a car in the early 20s.
Well, I guess in those days you'd have to be ready to do that. The engines were not as reliable as they are today. Maybe that brings us to her final vanishing. Remind us what was going on, what she was in the midst of when her airplane disappeared over the Pacific.
She was on the last leg of her flight, which was flying the Pacific, which, of course, was the most dangerous part. That particular leg had never been flown either. She took off from Ley, New Guinea.
Flying west to east here. She'd already flown sort of two-thirds of the way around flying east. She was on the equator.
Yes. She was flying the world at
west
its waistline.
West to east, right, right.
West to east, which was the way the prevailing winds of the Earth go.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a long flight, over 2,000 miles. And she had to put down there. It was approximately halfway to Hawaii, which was her next the final leg of her flight. And she had to find the island, which was 1.5 by 1 mile flat, although it did have a lighthouse on it. It was certainly easily missed. It was very low-lying. The Itasca, which was a Coast Guard vessel, was sending up a plume of black smoke to help her sight them. They were lying right alongside the island.
And she had a navigator on board with her.
And she had a navigator by the name of Fred Noonan, who mm-hmm. was one of the top navigators of his era.
Mm-hmm.
He was supposed to have been just a crack navigator, and he'd been with Pan Am. And much has been made of the fact that he had been fired by Pan Am for drinking, but I think that that's kind of a canard, because Amelia wouldn't have taken off. In the first place, they'd been all the way around the world except for this last segment.
Mm-hmm.
And in the second place, she was much too smart a person to have taken off with a navigator for the last most dangerous leg if he was in no condition to navigate.
But they had to put it down on this little tiny speck of land in the middle of an enormous ocean. Here's the way that this final chapter is presented in the movie Amelia. Here's Ewan McGregor as her lover, Richard Gere as her husband, Hilary Swank as Amelia Earhart, looking at that very challenging flight.
The closest land west of Hawaii is beyond the range of the Electra.
She'll refuel in the air.
She doesn't have the flying skills.
She's taking bigger risks.
Yes, I'm aware of that. Don't be so proud of it.
I understand the danger, fellas. I've studied the route. What have you come up with?
This is Howland Island. It's halfway between Honolulu and New Guinea. There's no elevation, no trees. Hardly anyone knows or cares that it exists.
It would be almost impossible to spot from the air.
It's really tiny, like a grain of sand in 1,000 miles of nowhere. If you miss this island, you're out of fuel with 2,000 miles to go.
From the movie Amelia, it wasn't her first effort in the Pacific, and the final one did not work. What's your understanding of what happened? Your best understanding, Susan Butler?
My best understanding is that the last transmission from her that the Itasca heard was that she was flying north and south. So she had either overshot the island or she hadn't reached it. Nobody knows. There's been a great deal of speculation. But they never sighted the island, and eventually they ran out of gas and crashed into the sea.
With us right now from Wilmington, Delaware, is Rick Gillespie. He's director of the International Group for Historic Aircraft Recovery, pronounced TIGER. He's led 8 archaeological expeditions to Nikumaruro, formerly Gardner Island, where he believes Amelia Earhart was marooned in 1937. He's the author of Finding Amelia. Rick Gillespie, thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Susan Butler has concluded quite firmly that she ran out of gas and went down somewhere in the sea. You think that maybe not. What's the scenario you think may have unfolded?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that I agree entirely with Susan about almost everything about Amelia's life and her message. And I agree that she was trying to find a very small island in a very big ocean, and I agree that the intuitive default conclusion of her not reaching that island is that she just got lost, ran out of gas, and went down at sea, unless there is reason to think that something else happened. And it turns out that there is abundant reason to think that something else happened, primarily the fact that for several days after she disappeared, radio distress calls were heard on her frequency, in her voice, firmly identified in some cases. We've cataloged something like 184 such occurrences. Some were hoaxes, transparent hoaxes, but some were had to be genuine. And Lockheed, the aircraft manufacturer, said that if you're hearing radio calls from this airplane, it has to be on land. They have to have the wheels down so that they can run the engine to recharge the battery. The only reason that those calls were discounted after the search failed is because they looked on the land where the signals were coming from. And incidentally, Pan American took radio bearings on the signals that cross near Gardner Island, now Nikumaroro. The Navy actually did send a battleship with airplanes to search the island. They saw something that shouldn't have been there, signs of recent habitation. But they didn't understand the significance of that.
So you're thinking she may have been a kind of Robinson Crusoe castaway on this island?
Classic. They were literally marooned on a desert island. 3 years later, a British colonial officer found the remains of a female castaway on the island, thought he found Amelia Earhart. The bones were sent to Fiji, British headquarters, where they were misidentified, and based on that, the British didn't contact the Americans. We've now found the spot on the island where those bones were found, the castaways' campsite, and we're recovering artifacts that speak of an American woman of the 1930s who had things with her that Earhart had with her. We're going back next year, and we think we're going to find DNA evidence that this is the answer to the mystery.
And with 8 expeditions under your belt and a lot of people having gone out with you, certainly you found that there's no end of interest in the Amelia Earhart story there. Rick Gillespie, author of Finding Amelia, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Susan Butler, Rick Gillespie, and others not giving up on Amelia Earhart here, not wanting to see her in shark-infested waters and all done back in 1937.
Well, I think that her plane is at the bottom of the ocean, and I think when the ocean is fully explored, the plane will eventually turn up. Quite a few years ago, there was an outfit called Nauticos, and the man's name, I think, was Jordan, who started searching the bottom of the ocean there around Howland Island, and he was, I think he had a lot of problems, actually. He had one of the first deep water robot subs. The problem is that the ocean in that area of the world is 17,000 feet deep, and we're just now developing technology that's going to allow us to search the ocean floor. And as Rick Gillespie said, and I'm very impressed with the energy and the time and everything else that he's devoted to this search. But as he mentioned, there was a pilot that overflew Nikumaroro, Gardner's Island, just a few days after she went missing. And the pilot of that plane, his only job, and of course you can imagine the hullabaloo and the importance that he knew that is of his task, he overflew the island and he didn't see anything that would make him radio back or that he later would think on the island that would merit a second look. But he didn't write a particularly illuminating report of what he'd seen, and or you could say he just wasn't a very good writer. I mean, so he wrote something rather ambiguous. But you have to believe that if he'd been set out by the United States government to see if there was a wrecked plane that could have been Earhart's on the island, he wouldn't have just have overflown it and never gone back.
What do you
hope? It just doesn't compute.
What do you hope after all these years, Susan, that Americans who see the new movie will take away when they think about Amelia Earhart? What's the message or the lasting significance you hope they'll leave the theater with?
Well, I hope they'll leave, in the first place, I hope they'll leave the theater having had a great experience. I mean, that's what a movie should give you, as a great experience. And I hope that they'll feel sort of uplifted. And I would like to say just one thing, which I always is in the back of my head when people say, well, she failed on her last mission. You could say that she failed on her last mission because this is the only flight she ever took where she was relying on a man.
Her navigator.
Her navigator.
If it's true, but it was a tough task for anybody in
absolutely,
those
it was
days.
A very tough task.
Susan Butler is author of the biography East to the Dawn, the life of Amelia Earhart. It's been really interesting. Thank you very much for being with us, Ms. Butler. Thank you very much for your work and joining us today.
Thank you. Your questions were terrific.
Thanks for joining us. Listeners, thank you for joining us as well. You can see the trailer for Amelia at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.